Coast Salish territory of the Hunkaminam speaking Musqueam people.
And you're listening live at 100.5 CFRO Co-op Radio, and it's time now for the Community Living Show. I'm Allison. I'm here with Michael.
Good morning, everyone.
And we're doing an interview with...
Her name is Laura Kessel, and she is a freelance journalist from... Cambridge, Massachusetts. Why am I getting tongue-tied all of a sudden? That's not cool. Okay, so this is a little bit about what we're going to talk about today. Working with a disability. And this is a writing from Laura herself. A decade ago, I was completing my master's degree in environmental science and policy. That's heavy stuff. And preparing to embark on a multi-decade career in advocacy and public policy that would require not only long hours during the work week, but frequent travel and overtime. Unfortunately, my body had other plans. We hear this from people a lot. Body having other plans,
yeah.
Or God has other plans, however you want to say it. Slowly, my experience began to erode my fantasies until finally my vision of a flourishing full-time career evaporated entirely. So, Laura, good morning.
Good morning.
Or actually, it's afternoon because you're in Massachusetts.
Yeah, it's afternoon. Yes. Good morning to you.
Can I ask what the condition was that eroded away your dream of being an environmental scientist?
Yeah, I mean, well, so I have several different chronic illnesses, and so it's been like a multi-year journey as different diagnoses came to head. I was originally diagnosed with fibromyalgia. I mean, I also have endometriosis, which is a reproductive disease, and I was getting migraines quite frequently as well. Usually like 4 or 5 times a month I'd get these debilitating migraines. I was diagnosed with fibromyalgia, which I think was kind of, I do think there's validity to my diagnosis, but I do think the doctors just gave it to me at the time because they didn't know what else to call it when I was having basically just all this chronic pain. But in the past 2 years, I was diagnosed with Ehlers-Danlos syndrome, which is a connective tissue disease, usually characterized by, like, I have, like, a lot of joint hypermobility, and, I'm deficient in collagen, and so it now makes a lot of sense, like, my history, like, I've been injuring myself very easily ever since I was a kid. Like, I would sprain my ankles or my wrists very easily, and in more recent years I've like partially dislocated my jaw just chewing on regular food. So I was having all these like injuries, and my spine and hips have a lot of degeneration that's pretty premature for my age, and I was also wondering why that had happened. Like, some doctors were like, oh, have you been playing aggressive sports for years? And I'm like, no, I have not, because they didn't understand why I was having all these degenerated and herniated discs in my back and torn up like cartilage in my hips. But now that I have the EDS diagnosis, that makes more sense, because basically my body is a lot more fragile and prone to injury and degeneration. So that, I think, is really the umbrella diagnosis that is responsible for a lot of the other diagnoses are under that main umbrella.
Mm-hmm. Well, I've worked with a charitable foundation up here on fibromyalgia. Mm-hmm. And one of the members of the Fibromyalgia Wellspring Foundation up here had EDS, or Ehlers-Danlos syndrome. It if I'm saying it correctly.
Yeah.
And she used to trip around a lot. Because her different joints would just slide in and out.
Yeah.
So, and from what I understand, that new stuff can be very painful. Just the dislocations and the relocations.
Yeah. So its biggest hallmark is just a lot of chronic widespread pain. And I've had pain on and off all my life. I've always been prone to pain. I had the growing pains as a kid that now they say a lot of times is an early marker that you probably have EDS that would wake me up throughout the night. But it's been probably in the past 4 years that it really got very bad. It became like a daily phenomenon instead of, you know, first it was like a few times a month I had it really bad, and then it was like weekly, but I still had good days, and then it finally just reached a threshold where it was like pretty much every day I was in pain. And that was been, you know, even before that I had started to work part-time even when it was more like weekly, because it was just interfering too much with trying to work a traditional full-time job here in the United States. So I was already doing that before the pain reached that, but I've had to scale back even more than I was since then in recent years and do mostly freelancing, because I found that even part-time jobs were not offering me the flexibility I needed with my body.
So freelancing in my world is also almost the same as being an entrepreneur too. So,
yeah.
Congratulations on that part. Because so many instead of pushing forward, they trip, they stumble, and they decide, well, I'll just stay down.
Mm-hmm.
Because as you described it, there's a lot of obstacles, especially that some employers may put in place if you're working at 9-to-5, because they want you behind a counter at a desk.
Yeah.
Whichever it may be, right?
Yeah.
So, and with which you described, that may not always be the optimal thing for you.
Mm-hmm.
So,
are there pain management stuff that you can take for this?
I mean, there's no specific. I mean, chronic pain. I've written a lot about this as a freelance writer. Basically, in the past few years, I've also focused more and more on health and healthcare advocacy. I mean, for me, I've had the best luck with medical marijuana and cannabis oil, but I mean, there really is not a lot of options out there for a lot of chronic pain patients. And I don't know if you're aware, I don't know how much of it is happening in Canada, but we have an opioid epidemic here in the United States. But what has happened is that has led to a lot of chronic pain patients being denied their medications of opioids. Many people who had been using their medications responsibly for years or decades, but now they're suddenly having their medications either drastically scaled down or cut off altogether and told to just take aspirin for people in very severe pain. So that's kind of been the fallout of the epidemic, is that a lot of people are being deprived their medications who need it and have been using it responsibly. So that's the problem for people. I personally don't take opioids because I have a family history of addiction, and so I never wanted to have that. And I'm also very sensitive to medications. They impact me very profoundly, so I didn't want to. The few times I've taken, like, codeine or stuff, I feel sick. So I've mostly had some luck with medical marijuana. But other than that, no, there's really not a lot out there. I mean, for some people, Lyrica or gabapentin have helped. It did not work for me. In fact, I found that it actually made me feel like a zombie, and I couldn't work while taking it at all because I was so exhausted and so disoriented from the medication, and I was on the lowest possible dose.
Yeah.
We also have in Canada an opioid issue. The radio station is in the poorest postal code in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
there was a documentary made right before the Olympics that were here, and the guy who made the documentary said that there are one in two have Hep C and one in three has HIV or something like that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So, and it's in a 10 block radius.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So also a lot of opioids, drugs in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, and most of that is the opioid abuse is due to the fact of disabilities, not due to the fact of people try to put well, that would help when my mic was actually turned on. People trying to self-medicate their way through their disability and try to cope with it, because the medical system just hasn't figured out what to do with them.
Yeah, and I don't know what the Canadian statistics are on that. I know in the United States a lot of the people who are found to have a problem, who have an addiction, are usually not their own medication. Mm-hmm. So that's why a lot of chronic pain advocates are saying, we're not the ones abusing medication, this is our prescription. It's usually other people getting it, and yes, they're either self-medicating, or to be honest, a lot of times they already had issues with addiction before they started taking opioids. They already mm-hmm. had problems with alcohol, problems with other non-opioid drugs like that they had already experimented with before turning over to opioids. And usually it happens more frequently in with young adults than older adults. It's complicated, but I know, you know, I've always felt a little in the middle, because as someone who grew up in a family with addiction issues, I don't want to take opioids, but at the same time, I know people in my chronic pain, I'm in a lot of chronic pain support groups, and they don't have addiction issues. They're just trying to manage their pain, and they're having their medications deprived of them. And I know that there have actually been studies that show that some people are having now, it's increasing suicide rates for those people in chronic pain who are now having their medications cut off.
Well, one thing that in the U.S. that we do have here in Canada, you're allowed a naturopath.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And which means that instead of being subjecting your body to harsh chemicals, that you can probably find a more natural path to it. Like you said, the CBD oils and the medical marijuana is one thing, but there's other hosts of herbs and things like that that maybe might be able to help. That is something that we have here that the U.S. still will not open up to such things on that.
I was just told by a medical professional, my mom, who's a nurse, that the opioids, because of the crisis, are highly controlled as well in Canada.
Yes.
Yeah.
And I know now marijuana is legal in Canada.
Mm-hmm. That's recreational
marijuana.
Yeah.
But I found out not too long ago about this soap dispensary place that puts, I think it was CBD, into mm-hmm. their bath products mm-hmm. to help relax the muscles, but it's not psychoactive mm-hmm. because it's not hot enough. The bath is not hot enough to activate the psychoactive stuff in CBD.
CBD doesn't have psychoactive.
CBD.
It's THC.
Or it could have been.
Yeah, it's THC that actually has it's the hallucinogen. We have a text message from somebody asking a question. Okay, let's get to the text message here before we have to get to the break. What is the biggest obstacle to overcome while living with your issues? like your current health issues with EDS and all.
So, would you like me to answer that in general, or more related to the theme of like working?
Let's keep it to the theme of working. Because that's what we're really trying to overcome here. Okay.
Yeah, because that actually probably is my biggest challenge. And again, I'm in the United States. A lot of these things vary by state too. And I'm fortunate that in Massachusetts we have, we're a relatively progressive state, and we do have a lot more. I feel like a better healthcare system than a lot of other states, and a lot more universal healthcare. Even before the Affordable Care Act passed. We had like Romney Care that our former mayor Romney signed in, like a universal health care bill. So I think that helps work too, is just having access to better health care, especially if you can't work full time. My partner actually is originally from the Carolinas, which is cheaper, and sometimes we've discussed moving there, but one of the reasons I could never move there is because I wouldn't have access to the health care I have here, and I need that health care to be able to function and to work. Mm-hmm. One of the challenges is, but then there is just the day-to-day. So I can't work a full-time job. And I just find one thing that's true everywhere, I think, in the United States, is that there really is just a lack of decent part-time work. I think, a lot of part-time work here, it isn't tiered like it is in, at least I know, some EU nations. It's like a percentage of what you get full-time, and they have come with benefits. But here, it's a mostly inherent assumption that, if you're working part-time, you're doing unskilled labor, and so the hourly wage is usually really low. It's minimum wage usually, mm-hmm. or close to it, and then there's no benefits. There's usually no vacation time. There's no health care benefits. Now, there are some exceptions, but they're just rare. And as I mentioned in the article that you read from that was posted in Harvard Health, for several years I worked a part-time job, just under half-time, for a municipal government here in Massachusetts, and it did pay a decent hourly wage, and I had an IRA account, and they were very flexible with their accommodations for me. Since it was half-time, they let me choose what days I needed to work a week. I was allowed to shift those days around most of the time as my health dictated. They let me telecommute if I really needed to. But I just find ever since I was laid off of that position that I could not find something comparable in both the rate of pay and just something that would offer me those kind of the kind of flexibility I needed. And now I had already been freelancing on and off for years, and I had been freelancing at the same time that I was working that position. So basically, since then, I've mostly just tried to ramp up my freelancing. But freelancing is very difficult too, because it's fickle. It's very feast or famine. Like you mentioned, it's like being an entrepreneur. So sometimes there's a lot of unpaid labor that goes into just trying to find work, a lot of networking, a lot of, for me as a journalist, a lot of time pitching different publications or trying to apply for a lot of different positions to do contract work. And I've tried to really be discerning now in the past couple of years, as my health did get worse, on how many pitches I'll put out or how many places. I really try to make sure it's a good match, because I can't, because my bandwidth is so limited, or like as you might have heard the saying, my spoons are so limited, that I don't want to be expending them if I really don't think there's a good chance I'm going to like get this article commissioned or get this place to contract me as a freelancer. So, I mean, that's basically it. It's just that balancing act of trying to work to survive, but I have my limitations, and I just don't think, at least in my country, and even in a state as progressive as Massachusetts, that there's not really a lot of like supports for like these gray areas. It's either like, oh, you have to be a full-time worker, or oh, you have to be on disability and not working at all. And mm-hmm. that's a problem too, because a lot of people, I personally, because I did work for so many years for a state government, I didn't pay into disability, like Social Security disability, and for that reason I didn't have enough credits to qualify for Social Security disability. And there's another kind of Social Security disability called SSI, which is for people who don't have the work credits, but it's so little. Like, I think it's like $700 a month, but I could never live on that. So I just don't have that option. So there's not a lot of gray area for people like me who can't afford to live on Social Security. And to be honest, I can work some, and I want to work some. I want to be able to be productive and contribute, but I just can't do it the way our society expects me to. So that's really, I think, the challenge, too.
Yeah. I think you put that really well. So hang on to that thought. I'm going to get back to some of the similarities that, and one of the reasons why we've, those similarities is why we brought you on this show. So just hang on a second, and we'll be right back from this break. Okay, hold on.
Okay, great.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, UBC, Vancouver.
When you join Balloon Club, we guarantee that you will be able to make a balloon poodle within the first day.
Here at the UBC Ant Club, we just like to talk about ants and compare ant farms. It's really cool.
Paperclip Club is all about, well, paperclips mostly.
At Blah Club, you can blah blah, blah 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 blah.
Explosion!
There's only one club worth joining at UBC, and that's CITR 101.9 FM. We got free tickets to shows, whirly pops, professional help in all types of audio engineering, passes to festivals, crazy parties, live band, swag. All types of crazy people. Our programming manager rides a motorcycle. There's freestyle rapping, Nardwar the Human Serviette, the vinyl and record libraries, Discorder magazine, free studio recording, and it sure beats the hell out of Paperclip Club, which is a thing that I just made up because I work at
CITR.
So come check us out on the top floor of the Student Union Building. We got all types of crazy shit for you to do. Or check us out online at www.citr.ca.
And we're back here at Community Living Radio, broadcasting live from CFRO 100.5 FM. And we're on with Laura, and she's a freelance a journalist from Cambridge, Massachusetts, and she just said some things that very much so mimic what's going on here in BC. So, Laura, are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Yeah. So here in BC, the average income for a person on disability, the same as you, is about $700 a month.
Last time I heard, it was about $750. So maybe. It's not that much more.
And here's the real kicker is, of course, our average rent is about $1,100-$1,200 a month for a one-bedroom apartment.
Yeah. And so, I've seen the cheapest just single room is about like $400-$500 a month just for a room.
Yeah. So very, very similar. And like you said, you want to work, but society has put this restriction that you work this way or you don't work at all, right?
Yeah, and I mean, there's some ways around it, but it's very difficult. And I don't even think I feel like a lot of people with disabilities struggle with this. And it's not even just people with disability. I think sometimes people who are, say, you know, young parents or single mothers with young children, you know, they also have these needs for, like, you know, maybe part-time work, but their options are limited and usually not well paid. And the cost of living is really pertinent too. Like you mentioned, I wrote a piece about last year for a disability website called Rooted in Rights, which was about affordable housing. And I looked at different studies, and the truth is anyone who is on Social Security, either SSI or SSDI, basically can't live in a one, you know, if it's, say, a single individual one-bedroom apartment in just about any part of the United States unless they're also getting some kind of housing subsidy or live in affordable housing. You know, they can't rent at market rate with the money they're making from SSI or SSDI. It does not cover the cost of living. They have to be subsidized. So I think that's, you know, shows that we're in kind of a bad place. Here's what it said. The report revealed the average monthly rent in the U.S. for a one-bedroom apartment was 104% of the average monthly SSI payment received by 4.8 million people with disabilities. So, I mean, it's just not even, you just can't even make it work. And even me working part-time, I live in affordable housing. I would not otherwise be able to live here in the Boston-Cambridge area, which is actually the third most expensive rental market, or at least it was as of a year ago. It's probably still in the top five in the United States. I was in a market rate apartment when I was working that municipal government job, and I was freelancing on the side. But only shortly after I moved into affordable housing, I got laid off of my position at the municipal government. And so I was lucky in some ways to be in affordable housing by that time, because there was no way I would have been able to struggle. But even now, even living in affordable housing, I'm paying, up till very recently, I was paying 100% or close to 100% most months of my monthly income to just rent.
Well, and see, that's the other issue, right? Okay, I'm not sure about Massachusetts, but here in BC, they say, well, you're allowed to make an extra $800 in income, and of course, after you go past the $800, they start literally. We live in a land of the clawback.
Yeah.
They just start scooping money back from you. It's like, okay, but I made $900. They take away the $100 from off of your disability. And it's like, and that's how are people supposed to get ahead, right?
Yeah, you know, you basically, it forces you to kind of live in poverty, under the poverty line. It's similar here. So if you're on Social Security disability, which is the one where, you know, you have to make a certain amount of work credits over a 10-year period. I think you can't, I forget what the maximum is, but in theory, if you, say, worked for decades and you become disabled, I think the maximum is in the $2,000 range. You're making like $2,000 a month, $2,200 a month. That's still not great, especially if you're living in a major metro area, but it's better than SSI. But still, I think you're only allowed to make about $850 in addition to that, say, if you need it. And what they don't tell you, too, though, unless you look it up in the fine print, is that I think if you make more than $800, $850 for more than 6 months in a row, they consider you, and I might be getting some of the specifics, but I think generally speaking, if you do it for more than a certain amount of months in a row, they tell you that, well, now you're getting, this is gainful employment, you don't need to be on SSDI because you're making this every month. For this many months in a row. So you could be making this then more, so you don't need this. And SSI, which is for, you know, the one that's around 700 a month average, my brother actually is disabled, and he's on SSI because he was disabled at a young age, so he didn't have any work history. He makes 700 a month. If you even make a few dollars, like you say, they then deduct those dollars.
Mm-hmm.
So you're basically not getting, it's not, it disincentivizes you working. And there is a program, I think it's called Ticket to Work, where you can have a little leeway for a few months where you're allowed to make a little money without them deducting, but it's only a small window, and after that they do deduct and then expect you to either just stay on SSI and not work at all, or you have to work and they'll kick you off SSI even if you're not making enough to really make to live. And my brother is living in Brooklyn. I grew up in Brooklyn, which is, New York is like the second most expensive city in the country. And the only reason he can still live there is because he has rent control. He inherited it from our grandparents. So it's the same apartment that my family's been living in since 1970. He inherited rent control. And even with rent control, he needs to have a roommate to afford it with his SSI.
Yeah, I remember New York and those rent control apartments were like, I don't know, it's like passing down gold. it's a very, very similar thing. So, but I'm not exactly sure how some of this works in the U.S., but one of the other obstacles that they put in place here is, you know how we have what is it? They have VancouverJobShop.ca and all these other job to help you find a job, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
but when they send out the resumes, how did the algorithms or whatever that they programmed to figure out, oh, who's going to be the best thing for when you receive your information, receive information back from these sites as an employer, they automatically, by way of the algorithms, because of work history, they eliminate people with disabilities because there's work gaps.
Yeah.
So how does freelancing help you? Does it help you get around the work gaps, or?
Yeah. I'm very fortunate. You know, like I said, I was freelancing for years. I've been freelancing on and off for years. Even when I was in grad school, I freelanced on the side to supplement my you know, income as a grad student. When I first got my master's, it was like right in the peak of the recession, the 2008 recession. So I used freelancing to bridge my income while I was trying to get a job. And I've always done some freelancing on the side. And then when I was working for the municipal government, I actually had a regular column at a financial news website. So it wasn't even, I didn't have to hustle very hard because I just had that weekly column and I was writing one or two pieces a week for that place. So that was a very nice, stable, like what freelancers call an anchor client. Like I just had that regular column. And that got gutted actually only not too long after I got laid off from my municipal government. So I had like a double whammy at once, but I already had that freelancing. I already had a foot in the door. I already had a lot of publications, a lot of bylines, so I could build on that and keep freelancing. You know, not everyone who's disabled already has a niche in something that they can do, especially from home, which is what I needed at the time. Like, there's not a lot of like work from home opportunities for people that are built in. And so I was fortunate that I already had that to fall back on and to try to expand. It still is challenging because, you know, journalism rates, I don't know how it's worked in Canada. I think it's happened globally as well. But I know in the United States, rates for journalists have gone down quite a bit. The online marketplace makes it easier for more people to write, but that means there's also a surplus of freelance writers willing to write, sometimes for very little, and that kind of like plunges the prices down. And I make a good turnover usually per piece, but I have freelance friends I know who work like 80 hours a week pitching constantly, and they do make a lot more money than I am, but again, I don't have the spoons to do that. So, you know, I'm maybe pitching, when I was pitching, I was maybe putting out four or five pitches a week, or sometimes only a couple, where they were putting out 15 or 20 pitches a week. I was lucky that I had the freelancing. I was lucky that I have that on my resume when I do try to apply for other part-time jobs, because it doesn't show a gap, because I've been freelancing regularly. I haven't stopped, even though I've slowed down, I've always continue to work there, so I don't have that gap that other people do. I mean, it's still a challenge though, because I find in this society we still don't value freelance workers or freelancers as much. So I sometimes think that sometimes people are like, "Oh, you were a freelancer," and same thing with part-time work. I just don't think it's valued as much sometimes. So sometimes I've been I'm evasive on my resumes at times, you know, about my job for my municipal government job. I don't say it's part-time unless I'm either applying for another part-time position so that they know that that's what I'm looking for, or until it comes up in the interview, I might then clarify that it's part-time, but I don't put it in my resume that it's a part-time position. I mean, I'm also, when I do look for part-time work, I'm competing with people who don't necessarily want to work part-time or need to. They want to work full-time, but we still have this post-recession economy where there's a lack of good full-time jobs. So there are a lot of people I'm competing with for these jobs who I need to work part-time, but they actually want to work full-time, but they're just settling for part-time positions. So, you know, the competition pool is stiffer with people. And same thing for freelancers. I think more people are freelancers nowadays just because of the economy. They're either doing it in addition to working full-time because they're still having a hard time making ends meet, or for whatever reasons. I have a lot of friends who are freelancers who are young mothers with young children from home, and they can't afford daycare, so they're freelancing. Right. They gave up their newspaper, you know, regular daily newspaper reporter job to freelance from home so that they could stay at home with their kid. So I think that you know, I don't mean to digress too much from your original point, but that those all play factors too.
Yeah, it does actually play factors because we're all kind of in the media business here.
Yeah,
and, it happens.
And one of the other things is the online subscription part, right? Mm-hmm. Like in Seattle, what is it? Like a few years ago, one of the Seattle newspapers just went. They stop printing, and only way you can get them is online, which also meant that they cut out I don't know how many staff members, including staff journalists, because they only kept the ones that had the most prominent columns. The rest of them they let them go. Like they emptied out the city desk for a newspaper to thrive. As we know, in the media business, city desk is like that's it. That's your meat and potatoes, because that fills most of your newspaper. They actually let most of the city desk go, except for a few columnists.
Yeah.
So it was like, that's kind of crazy too, and you're seeing a lot of that happening don't get me wrong, I respect and I really like the Huffington Post. Don't get me wrong. but it's models like that that are also putting out a lot of the traditional journalism and media positions out.
Yeah.
So,
and I mean, I want to give kudos to just, like, Huffington Post was a big problem for a long time because they were not paying a lot of their contributors. Mm-hmm. Like, a lot of their contributors. They just changed their thing a year ago that they do now pay their contributors. But what happened as a result of that was interesting, is so I was actually writing I was ghostwriting a column for a nonprofit that actually helps people financially who have chronic illness get the surgeries or treatments they need. So I was ghostwriting a column on Huffington Post, and it was the organization I was ghostwriting for was paying me to write this. I was writing two columns a month, and they were paying me pretty well too. But when Huffington Post did that, even though it's good that they were paying their contributors, because the column they weren't paying, they cut my column. And then we couldn't find another place that would feature the column, so I lost a gig. So even though I was really happy that Huffington Post was paying their journalists, the fallout was I lost my position ghostwriting that column on Huffington Post that organization was paying me to write.
Right, right.
Yeah, so, I mean, that's what it is. It's like this constant hustle when you're a freelancer. Things that you can't even anticipate sometimes. Like, even places that seem to do well. I've written for places that seem to be doing very well, and then they'll just gut, like, they'll just gut their budget, or they'll cut their freelance budget and say, we're having financial problems. Mm-hmm. We can't pay you anymore.
Yeah, well, up here, I'm a freelance photographer, videographer, and that's how I got to start my own corporation, Depictions Media. In some respects, people call and say, "Oh, can you come out and cover this?" Is like, and or can you come photograph this or shoot video of that? Or in they don't always want to pay.
Yeah.
So it's you're always having to get keep that hustle on, right? So.
Yeah.
So a lot of what we wind up doing is, of course, volunteer. Like this particular radio show is a volunteer thing for this radio station.
Mm-hmm.
So CFRO, we're all full of we're all activists and things like that, and volunteer broadcasters in this respect. But I also do manage to make a couple dollars here and there with Depictions Media, so as a paid model, but it's not always easy.
No.
So, okay, so we're gonna hang on to that thought about strategies for actually making money as a freelancer, because I think you probably have some really cool strategies for that, and we'll be right back after this break.
Okay.
You are listening to CITR 101.9 FM, UBC, Vancouver.
Let's listen in as one poor soul tries to find something good to enjoy on the radio.
Let's see here. World of Warfare. God. Oh.
Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance.
Oh. Everybody. God, this is awful.
Well, I climbed up the mountain, climbed back down again for you. I climbed up the mountain again for you, and then I climbed back down, climbed up.
Oh, isn't there anything?
Listening to the radio these days can be distressing. Fortunately, here at CITR, our programmers choose the music that they play, so our charts reflect what people actually listen to. To find out what's really topping the charts, pick up a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or check us out online at citr.ca. Unless, of course, you'd rather keep listening to the chart-topping single, Everybody Dance.
What, you don't like to dance? Everybody dance. Everybody dance. Everybody dance, dance. What, you don't like to dance?
And we're back. And we're speaking with Laura. Did I pronounce your last name correctly at the beginning of the show? Kessel?
You were close. It's Kiesel.
Kiesel. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah, Laura Kiesel, freelance photographer in Cambridge, Massachusetts. But that's okay, because I'm going to tell the secret of how I found Laura. And for those of you who might actually want to look into doing some freelance work, or if you're trying to find a way to actually get reporters to pay attention to you, go to helpareporter.com, and that's actually how I found Laura, so we could do this interview today, and we find a few people through that source. Okay, so are there any specific strategies to helping you to helping people finding paid work as a freelancer?
So I mean, I find that networking is important, and of course that can be difficult when you have a disability. Mm-hmm. But I think that we're fortunate in some ways. I mean, I have a love-hate relationship with social media, but I find that it's kind of crucial to finding work for me. So I've joined a lot of Facebook groups that are for writers and journalists, and Twitter feeds, but Facebook has actually been where I've gotten the lion's share, where I've actually, you know, there are editors on these Facebook pages, and they'll put out calls for writers, and, you know, I usually, you know, I get right on that. So that's one way, is just to really try to maximize or use social media to your advantage. And again, I say this as someone who's kind of a Luddite. I don't really like social media, but I just have find that it's necessary for me to find work. As I mentioned, because of my health issues and being low in spoons, I feel like I have to, I really try to focus more on quality than quantity, and I, instead of just, say, carpet bombing like 20 pitches a week to all these different publications, which I used to do, but I just don't have the energy, I really just focus on finding a place that I really think is a good match, would really like what I'm writing about, and I try to then, when I do get a foot in the door there, I try to build on that relationship, and I really try to find places that'll give me regular work. Like, I don't want to just pitch a place, write a one-off for them, and then never write for them again. I want to write, you know, at least a few pieces for a place, or, you know, ideally I would like to have another column again, like I had when I was writing for the economics site The Street a few years back. I really enjoyed writing a regular column. I enjoyed the column I was writing for Huffington Post. for the organization Good Days, which was on health issues. Mm-hmm. So that's what I've tried to do, is do that. I've found that as I've put myself out there more and more, more people come to me with work, and that's really the best scenario. It doesn't happen all the time, but, you know, 4 or 5 years ago, no one would come to me. But now I actually occasionally get editors or places that will write me and say, do you want to write for me and offer me a position? And I think that's because I've put myself out there a lot on social media. Right now I write a regular column for Health Union, and they have, like, different blogs for different for all these different health issues. So I write for their endometriosis site. I write for their irritable bowel syndrome site. Mm-hmm. And I actually came upon that just because I also teach part-time at a school called Grub Street here in Boston, which is a writing school. And just one of my students wrote for them because I actually was teaching a one-day class at Grub Street about writing about disability and illness, and she had a disability. And she was like, do you want to write for this place? And I, you know, at first I didn't even think much of it. I was like, oh, I'll talk to them. But it turned out to be a really good opportunity because they do let you write a lot of pieces for them per month, or at least they were. Again, they've kind of cut their budget a little back, but, like, so I just try to be open to all those things and meet people and talk to them and put myself out there on social media, pitch places. I'm also, you know, I subscribe to several different mail services that specialize in different publications or organizations that are looking for writers. So I get those in my inbox, like, every day and look at them. And, you know, a lot of them are not, you know, like, I'll look at the opportunities. Some of them are not paying enough, or they seem like scams. But there's usually at least a few decent ones in every post, and I'll put those aside, and I'll apply or send an email introduction if I think that it's a good match.
Yeah. That sounds like really good stuff for people to, because being a freelancer in a lot of directions is, I think that, I don't know how you feel about this, but I think it's going to start to become the way of the future, because there's a lot of places they're gutting their budgets, because either there's not enough tax breaks or whatever the situation would be. Like here in BC, like I said, the rents are extremely high for residential. Can you imagine what it is for a small business trying to get office space rental? Mm-hmm. You know, it's like it's through the roof. We're joint ventured in a video studio, and our rent is over $6,500 a month.
Wow. Yeah.
And it's like, it's a nice space and everything, but it's like, it's kind of expensive. And of course, we've hit this thing with that, where is either we have to really ramp up the revenue, or like serious budget cuts, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of economics going into how this how business models are working these days.
Mm-hmm.
I mean you're out there all the time. You see any relief for that, or is it going to continue the same?
Yeah, I don't know. And some of these places, I mean, some online places don't even have any offices for online publications. I think some of that is also just dictated by the fact that it's hard to make money online, because it's not, mm-hmm. you know, in the days of, like, where people were reading hard copy newspapers, you know, you had advertisers and people buying the newspapers or magazines, and that helped stimulate, you know, a revenue that they could then pay their freelancers. But online, it's more difficult. A lot of the content's for free, so a lot of people aren't paying subscriptions to pay for it, and then it's harder to get advertisers. I mean, I know Facebook's done a good job of that, but for a lot of these online magazines, it's more difficult for them to get advertisers that will pay enough revenue. Because I know a few really good startup online publications that had some really great work, but they went under because they just could, and they were paying their writers. Some of them, some decent, you know, not fabulous, but not bad either. But, like, they went under. And a lot of times they were paying out of their own pockets because they did believe in paying their freelancers, but they were just not able to find a model for getting revenue. I mean, I do see some changes that seem to be heartening, but they usually seem to be with the really prestigious papers. Like, I know Washington Post a year or so ago, like, hired a bunch more journalists. And finally were, you know, in some of the New York Times. So some of the bigger papers seem to be rebounding and hiring more people. And I know that they do now have a subscription thing where if you read more than a few, and more of the smaller magazines are doing this too, where if you read more than four or five articles a month, you use up your quota and then you have to subscribe. You know, Medium, which I sometimes blog on Medium, is doing this as well. You know, they... if you read a certain amount of Medium posts that are behind a paywall, then you have to start paying a monthly fee if you want to, like, read on Medium. And I actually have made a little bit of money blogging on Medium, you know, so I think their model works a little bit, just trying to make people subscribe if they want to read content and not just give it all away for free. You know, give some of it away, but just enough to get people interested to pay. But, you know, I think it's still a work in progress, and I think people are still trying to struggle with how to make this new market work.
Yeah. And that's one of the other things that we do. We give you, we'll let you have so much of an interview for free, and then you got to go behind the paywall to get the rest of the interview.
Oh, okay.
So,
yeah, that's good.
Yeah. But There are some ins and outs with that one, because in you're talking dollar downloads, it's like you really gotta ramp up the visitors.
Yeah, you have to have a lot of reads or clicks. Yeah.
Yeah, and if you're not big, they're like, no one wants to pay like $10 because, well, you're not that big. I'm going to give that to New York Times.
Yeah. it's pretty challenging. I mean, that's why I think it works for Washington Post or Boston Globe or New York Times, but why I don't think it has worked for the smaller publications trying. And that's why I think some of them have gone under, because they just don't have the numbers. And, you know, when I write for Medium, which I don't do a lot, but I've tried a little bit, you know, it's still, I get paid if I get a lot of clicks and claps. And, you know, that's okay sometimes if I just want to write something. But when I write for a magazine, I know actually when I was writing for The Street, at some point they're like, we want to change your pay system so that you get paid by clicks or by how many people click on your piece. And I'm like, no, I want to keep my current contract where I get paid, you know, I get paid a flat rate per article of this, you know, size, because I knew that even though maybe a few articles might have gotten enough clicks, I knew some, you know, it's not all of them are going to get clicks that are going to pay for that. I mean, and it was something like, you know, a quarter, 10 cents a click. So I would have had to get a lot of clicks to make up the money. So some of them are going to that model, and I don't, you know, and it can really undermine, like, payments for freelance writers like myself.
Yeah. Well, being a freelance video person, part of a freelance video team, Amazon Prime, you can get high quality stuff. They will actually accept your uploads, and we have done that. We've gotten our uploads accepted by Amazon Prime, but they won't cut you a check until you have hit $100 or more in revenue. Otherwise, they say it costs them too much money to cut the checks. So if you don't get enough clicks, you don't reach the $100. And theirs is an interesting model, because if they're charging a dollar for a download, you as the artist get 10 cents.
Yep.
So that's 1,000 downloads that you have.
Yeah, they're taking a big cut.
Yeah. So that's one of the other interesting parts. But it can be done. Well, I will say that. It can be done. And there's strategies to making things successful. So, but with that being said, can you give us give everybody out there the best ways to get a hold of you if they're looking for a ghostwriter? Because you did say you do ghostwriting.
Yeah, or if they want a column, or if I do ghostwriting. I do columns. I I do editing too, though I prefer more nowadays to do writing and journalism. But yeah, my email is the best way. My website is laurakiesel.com, LauraKieselL.com. I'm revamping my website right now, so it may be a little problematic from time to time because I'm actually trying to unveil a new website in the next week or two. And my Gmail address, which is where you and I have been corresponding, is great, which is LaKiesel, LaKiesel@gmail.com.
Mm-hmm.
And people just Google Laura Kiesel. They'll find me too because my last name's pretty rare.
Yeah,
so usually I'm the first Laura Kiesel to come up.
Yeah, and also I'll look for you on, of course, on Facebook because I would love for you to be part of the Community Living Radio Facebook page.
Oh, that was
and,
great!
There's a lot of activism going there, and who knows what opportunities could pop up from that. So. Okay.
Yeah.
So it was wonderful speaking with you today.
Thank you so much,
Thank
Laura.
Yeah.
Yeah, no problem.
And for those of you who also listen on our podcast version through depictions.media, look for Laura in another broadcast that's going to happen this month when we have our media marketing event at the Kinetics Media studio in Burnaby, BC. And we're going to have Laura come back and talk more about small businesses and media strategies. So how to get that journalist to find you. So that's going to be our topic for over there, and we'll be live broadcasting that. So look for Laura on that day also, okay? So
I look forward to that.
Yeah, I think it's going to be a lot of fun, and hopefully we'll have a really full room for that event, okay? So
great.
With that, bye for now, Laura, and you have
bye.
A great afternoon, and we'll continue forward with our morning.
Yeah, you too.
Okay.
Have a great day. Bye.
Okay, bye.
Bye. That was so neat, and
yeah.
So many similarities between Laura's experience and experiences of people who have disabilities in Canada
yeah.
and in BC.
In BC, yeah. So very interesting. But I'm glad to hear that she hasn't just fallen over and given up. That's
yeah.
the important part.
Yeah.
We can't give up. We have to keep going forward. And I think that's going to be my final thought for today.
Yeah.
What do you think?
I think that's good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Bye for now.
Bye for now. Thank you. Hi, Grandpa, by the way.